I'm Jane Lee, and this is The Full Story. Until recently, the Family Court of Australia was responsible for resolving the country's most complicated fights over parenting, custody, and property issues. But for many years, this specialist court has been criticised as dysfunctional, leaving families waiting years and years for a decision. So earlier this year, the Family Court was merged into a General Law Court and rebranded as the Federal Circuit and Family Court of Australia. This merger has been heavily criticised by the legal community, including by Women's Legal Services. So what will this mean for families? And will this new court fix these long-standing problems? Today, the end of the Family Court as we know it. It's Wednesday, the 6th of October.
My name's Colin Forrest. I am a former judge of the Family Court of Australia.
Before he was a judge, Colin Forrest worked for a long time as a family law barrister.
I was appointed to the court at the beginning of 2011 after 20 years practising principally in family law at the Queensland Bar.
It was a job that he really enjoyed.
What was it about that area of law that you liked?
I liked helping people.
Nino, what do we need to know about the family court and how it works?
So up until recently, we had two different family courts. We had the Federal Circuit Court, which handles simpler family disputes, as well as immigration and commercial cases. And we also had the Family Court, a specialist court that only dealt with the most complex family cases.
Nino Bucci is a reporter specialising in legal and justice issues for Guardian Australia.
So depending on the type of issue you'd had, you'd end up in one of these two courts to get it resolved. Now, if we're talking about a relationship breaking up, no huge amounts of property involved, no children, you'd probably end up in the Federal Circuit Court. But if you had, for example, serious conflicting allegations of child abuse, you know, millions of dollars worth of property that was involved in conflict, you'd find yourself in the Family Court where the most serious matters got resolved.
And Nino, when you started at The Guardian, you were asked to focus on the Family Court. Why was that?
What we were trying to do is look at why cases that on the face of it shouldn't be that difficult to resolve and were fairly routine matters that unfortunately happen to people frequently in life. Relationships break down and they try and get a resolution about who gets to spend what time with the kids or, you know, who owns this proportion of this property. In some cases, they were getting bogged down for years and years and years in a court system that wasn't really getting anywhere. It's sort of clear, regardless of what side of government you're on, regardless of whether you're a lawyer who works in this system or a judge who works in this system or someone who files in the family court wanting to resolve a problem that you've got with a relationship, that the system was fundamentally failing on a number of levels.
And imagine that delay in family law cases where you've got children growing up waiting for decisions to be handed down. That delay can make a pretty big difference to people's lives. So do any particular cases stick out for you in terms of how those delays played out in real life?
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, a case where a woman had her children taken off her when she was in labour and unrepresented in court because, you know, the message hadn't kind of got through to the judge who was looking at it that, you know, she was in labour that day and she wanted an adjournment. And that situation took years to resolve itself after the decision was made.
And then you have other horrific examples where cases are in the family court for years. You have kids or a partner who are harmed or even killed before that case is resolved. And that's obviously the worst case scenario. And overall, there's just all these stories of people who go into this system with serious problems and years later they're unresolved or they're still stuck in the courts and this can cost them millions of dollars. And in some circumstances, I've heard of legal fees in excess of that, multi-millions of dollars, and they still haven't got any resolution.
And I should mention that Colin Forrest, the retired judge we've spoken to for this episode, wasn't one of the judges responsible for delays in any of those cases you've mentioned there. But I'm curious, Nino, what have you found out about what's been driving this delay in the family courts?
It's sort of difficult to sort of put a finger on one particular thing that has caused this machine to break down, kind of like any machine that is sort of under constant pressure. They're going to find weak points that just fail. And it's almost as if there's just this funnel of the one size, but the water that's being put into that funnel is being put at the exact same rate, and eventually everything's just going to spill over. So, you know, you might find in certain cases that a particular judge has made a really bad decision, but that could be because that judge has got as many as 600 cases that unresolved at the time. And because this is kind of like an ecosystem, if one thing fails, then that leads to a delay, which then leads to a cost, which then leads to somebody else disputing that cost. And it just kind of becomes this huge system where it's kind of hard to know exactly what came first.
I would consider that the hardest cases I had to decide were indeed cases where allegations of sexual abuse were being made and had to be determined. Most often the mother would be making an allegation that she believed that the father had sexually abused one or more of the children and had stopped the father seeing the children for that reason. And, you know, generally the father denying that he had abused them, you're having to hear the case often with one or both of them without legal representation.
It's clear that the court is hearing far more of these types of allegations. I mean, I guess what we've seen over the past decade is a reckoning around how common family violence is, how common child abuse is, and that's found its way into the family court system because it's impossible to resolve some of these disputes without addressing issues that are being raised about the way a, you know, a woman or a child has been dealt with in a lot of these relationships that have broken down.
So it sounds like, you know, from what you're saying, we've got more child abuse allegations, more family violence allegations, and more nuanced understanding of all of these types of problems in family disputes. So what impact overall has that had on the family law system?
Basically, you're asking family courts to resolve issues that they wouldn't have necessarily had to resolve anymore. They were already under-resourced and they were already spending a lot of time trying to get to the bottom of things that were as, you know, relatively straightforward as property disputes or who should have the most time with the children. Now they're looking at, is this woman being abused? Is this child, you know, in real fear of being abused? And is there allegations that they've made about one of the parents abusing them backed up by any facts? And so it's just added another layer of complexity to a process that was already fairly convoluted.
So this huge workload obviously grows over the years. What did that look like?
Well, what it looks like is that there's more and more cases in the list of cases waiting to get allocated to the judge, and there's more and more cases in the list waiting for trial. Then when you finish your case, of course, you walk out of the courtroom and you've got to go away and write a judgment, but invariably within a day or two or three, you're into your next trial and often don't have enough time to write a judgment. If you've heard a two-week trial, you generally need 2 weeks to write the judgment. And gradually the list of your reserve judgments grows, and that becomes an incredible burden on you and, frankly, causes you to lose sleep.
What was that like for you personally?
It's worrying. It's a burden. The worry of, I've still got to write that judgment, I've still got to write that judgment. Those people are waiting for that decision, and I know, it's my obligation to write it. Mm.
The backlog in the courts is quite incredible when you sort of break it down to the numbers. When you sort of deal with the lower section of the court, you know, what we heard last year from a parliamentary committee is that you had some judges in that lower section, which is known as the Federal Circuit Court, having 600-plus cases on their docket. So that's 600 cases that they are expected to resolve as part of their job. I mean, it's impossible that you're going to be able to get through them. You know, I mean, even if you were able to resolve one a day, you know, that's still, you know, almost 2 years worth of work. So you already had a system that was not coping with the level of work that it had, that was now expected to rule on even more complicated matters that would involve allegations of family violence and child abuse. And it just didn't cope. But not only was it not functioning, there was no increase in resources that would go anywhere near being able to help that court system cope with demand.
And just to be clear, Nino, when you say more resources, I'm guessing you mean federal funding for things like judges, admin staff, all of the things that keep the court ticking over, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's been calls sort of going back decades, really, that there's not enough judges, there's not enough people to basically push these matters through so that they can get resolved as quickly as possible. Because, you know, the very nature of these disputes means a lot of the time it's not like a criminal court where, you know, someone gets found guilty, the sentence gets handed down, that's it, see you later. They might appeal to a higher court down the track if they've got grounds, but that's largely it. You know, the way these matters work is that you might get a decision, one of those parties isn't happy about it, they go back to court. They can drag on for years and years and years. So it's not as simple as being able to just clear the books of that matter and off you go. You know, as soon as somebody's filed in that court, there is the potential, depending on how complex the case is, that that's something that is going to be on your books for years. And that's basically what people were, within that court system were saying to me, is that we just did not have the resources to cope with this.
How important was this background in family law to your role later as a judge of the family court?
Having represented people, husbands and wives, mothers, fathers, grandparents, independent children's lawyers over many years, you know, coming to the bench, you come with the knowledge and experience of what each of them is going through, what it's like listening to their stories, how they're presented. But also, you also understand the weaknesses and the strengths in their cases. I believe it gave me a little bit more empathy, understanding of what the parties were going through, and an ability to cut through a lot of the emotional stuff to actually understand the real nature of the dispute, the fundamentals of what the dispute was about.
So when I started digging around this issue a little, I would find that there'd be certain cases that were being overturned on appeal because of what looked like fairly rudimentary errors. In some cases, you could kind of, I suppose, excuse that because of the workload of the judges, but it also became clear that an issue here was that you'd be getting people appointed to that lower level of the family law courts, the Federal Circuit Court. You'd be getting judges appointed to that who didn't actually have family law experience.
Sounds really strange, you know, because, for example, in criminal court, you'd expect that a judge would have to know a fair bit about criminal law and about the way it works in reality before they'd get to decide whether someone goes to jail. So why is this different in the family court? Why is it that judges are able to be appointed without any family law background?
Yeah, so there are a number of things to keep in mind here. First, the Federal Circuit Court, which is the lower level of the family law courts, is a general court. So judges on that court will hear a range of different cases, not just the lower level family law cases. They might hear immigration cases or consumer law and privacy cases as well. So when the Attorney General goes to appoint these judges, they have to think about the right people for all these different types of cases. And the other thing to know is that judges in that jurisdiction don't get paid a whole lot of money, but it's seen as a bit of a stepping stone.
And then because of the workload and because, you know, so much of the Federal Circuit Court's workload, you might get them shoved into family law matters where there's demand rather than into the commercial matters and other things that they might have more legal experience in, simply because that's where the demand is in the Federal Circuit Court.
For Colin Forrest, one of the other critical issues in the court that seemed to get worse over his time there was the lack of free legal help for some of the most vulnerable people appearing before him.
The number of cases in the family court where I was hearing a case where there was either one of the parties didn't have legal representation or both of them didn't have legal representation was gradually increasing over those years. And really, that's a reflection of a reduction in legal aid funding in Australia over the last 5 or 6 years or longer.
We're basically in a situation where legal aid funding has been decreasing for years now. And that means, obviously, that if you're in a position where you're not able to afford a lawyer yourself and you're not able to get government funding for that lawyer, you're going to rock up and represent yourself, you know, act as a self-represented litigant, because you're that desperate to get some sort of resolution here. And again, that is one of the things that can kind of fall down in this ecosystem that then leads to more delays, that then leads to more costs for the other party. And, I mean, you feel for the people who are doing it because they've obviously got to a point where they're not happy with the outcome of the court, but they also can't afford a lawyer and they're not going to be given any funding for a lawyer. And all that does is increase the pressure on the other parts of the system.
Colin Forrest says all of these cases were complex, many involving abuse, addiction, or mental health issues. And year after year, more of them involved people without legal representation, which meant that many cases took longer to resolve or would often go off the rails.
You can imagine where people don't have lawyers and they're involved in some of the most emotionally traumatic, you know, court proceedings of their lives, or where allegations are being made by one against the other that of horrendous nature. They can become very unrestrained. You know, often they just let fly. They often pick a fight with the judge in circumstances where they shouldn't. So as a judge, you have to deal with that. You still have to be true to your oath and try to decide a case without fear or favour, and that makes it tough.
And on top of that, you'll get some people who haven't received funding because they don't necessarily have a case and they don't necessarily meet the threshold for funding. So they'll keep representing themselves to push it through the system. That'll cause further delays, which will result in further costs to the other parties. And you've got another sort of problem in that ecosystem that, again, can only really be solved by resourcing.
So, Nina, it sounds like there have been all these problems with the family court languishing for years. How did the federal government set out to fix these problems?
So in 2018, they announced an intention to effectively merge the lower tier of the court, the Federal Circuit Court, with the family court.
What this reform is designed to do is take a complicated system that has two courts dealing with family law matters, where people in the system are bounced around like family law footballs from court to court.
And early on, Attorney General Christian Porter claimed that the changes were aimed at reducing the costs and delays that thousands of Australian families experience as a result of a split federal family law court system.
Less time to resolution, less on legal fees, and ensure that these families...
But this was incredibly controversial.
Next, how is the new family court system working now? So, how did the legal community respond to this idea of a merging of the family courts?
Yeah, look, not well. Now, as we've outlined, this court had a lot of issues, but it was still a specialised court which had been around since 1975, and it was considered a bit of a world-leading institution in dealing with family law matters.
The Law Council of Australia particularly was vocally against it. They were joined in opposing it by a lot of different legal groups, ranging from women's legal services.
Well, up to 85% of matters through the family law system, or family law courts actually, involve matters of domestic violence. And the best protection in relation to domestic violence cases now and into the future is really to have a standalone specialist family court.
So Aboriginal legal services.
There are systemic problems on the ground with being able to make sure that safety is first and foremost.
The Labor Party, you know, the federal opposition were very much against it. They felt that the family court was something that should be bolstered, given more resources, and not folded into a lower court as part of this single entry model. There was certainly no opposition to the idea that reforms were needed. You know, the opposition was to the type of reforms.
And what were these legal groups worried would happen if the courts were merged?
They were worried that you were dismantling the family court, which was seen as this, I suppose, beacon of best practice in terms of, you know, hearing the interests of children and how to respond to them, you know, dealing with complex property disputes, making sure that women had a voice and that women's concerns about economic control and, you know, coercive control and the like were heard. Instead of that layer of the courts, the family law courts getting the resources they needed, they felt that the federal government was effectively saying, this is all too hard, let's blow the lot up and make it basically a new version of the federal court.
That potentially has less resources over time because it's a smaller system.
Yeah, that's right. Less resources and less specialisation. You know, they felt that, look, if you're getting rid of the family court, you're getting rid of what makes that such an important institution and what makes that so valuable when it's working at its best for the most vulnerable people, you know, women and children. And so they felt basically that it was diminishing the family court and it wouldn't result long term in any improvements in terms of outcome.
Earlier this year, Colin Forrest left his role as a judge of the family court, 10 years earlier than the law would have required him to retire at the age of 70. It was a rare move for a sitting judge. And one of his reasons for leaving was the challenge of hearing these difficult cases.
They basically take their toll on you. So after 10 years, I thought I'd had enough of hearing those sort of cases on a daily basis.
But there was also another reason.
I decided a year or 18 months out from when I did resign that I was going to resign.
What were some of the factors you were weighing up?
Well, Jane, honestly, I became fairly disillusioned about with the whole merger proposal, and I was against it, and so were many of my colleagues. And I actually took the extraordinary step of signing off on a letter that was written on behalf of many of us who were against the merger, which I sent round. I sent on behalf of those of us who were against it to bar associations, law societies. I even sent it to the Prime Minister, who was Malcolm Turnbull at the time. Yeah, once it looked as if it was definitely going to go through, I was certainly committed to leaving the court then. I received some criticism for that from certain quarters, including from the government itself, because of a notion that sitting judges shouldn't go public on things like that.
Well, I mean, it is pretty bold, right? It goes against that convention that judges stay out of public debates on policy. Why did you decide to send this letter?
The judges of the court, or many of them, felt as if we were personally being attacked by government and used as scapegoats, blamed for what you say was perceived to be a broken system, when the real explanation for that lay in government neglect of resourcing.
And did that contribute to your decision to leave early?
Yes. Honestly, yes.
And in a nutshell, are you able to summarise the main reasons that you were against the merger and thought it was a bad move for the court or a bad direction for the court to go in?
I have certainly come to consider the family law system to be a very important part of the social fabric of this country. I am a total believer that the family court should be a standalone specialist court just dealing with family law matters, where people who are appointed judges are experienced and skillful, competent, empathetic family lawyers. And I believe it should have always remained a separate and distinct court and not merged downwards into with the Federal Circuit Court, which is a court that does family law, principally family law, but is also a generalist federal court as well.
Okay, so now we have this merged Federal Circuit and Family Court of Australia. How is this new model designed to improve the lengthy delays that were involved in the old system?
The idea was that you'd have a single point of entry, which would basically then make it easier to triage, I guess, where these cases would end up in the court system. So you wouldn't get what was happening under the existing model, which was cases bouncing around between jurisdictions, certain judges hearing certain things, and overall the outcome being longer times to resolve cases and more costs to everybody.
So what do you mean by triaging? What does that actually look like?
Well, the federal government provided funding for more than 40 court officials called judicial registrars to help better manage the caseload of this merged court. Registrars aren't judges, but they have administrative power to decide where a case belongs. So it might be that something that is a property dispute with not a whole lot at stake that will get sorted in the lower tier system. But on the flip side, you've got cases that might be worth, you know, millions of dollars of property. They'll have, you know, four kids they've got to decide custody over. That'll go to the higher tier. So it's a way of determining the best solution to solving cases.
And try to get them through the court more quickly that way, I guess.
Yeah, the idea being that if you get somebody looking at these cases with a critical eye as early as possible, you'll then be able to work them through the court system quicker because you'll be able to identify which ones need specialist intervention early and which ones you can basically just look at, you know, what each side's alleging and close the book on.
Mm. Okay, so what else is happening in this space?
Yeah, well, just before the court was merged, they actually called up a bunch of retired judges to try and help them clear some of the backlog of cases that were still waiting to be resolved. And what the court is also saying is that under this new model, they're actually going to have more judges than they've ever had before. So that should also help them move through things quickly. We've also seen the establishment of a few different streams that would handle specific types of cases. So cases where there's allegations of family violence would go through a separate stream than cases that involve allegations of child abuse, and there will be a separate stream, for example, that are cases that are on a COVID list, so a list of cases they need resolved quickly because of the pandemic. So all these things, you know, family lawyers that are kind of optimistic about the reforms, all these things they say could make a real difference to the functioning of the court.
There is this perception, I think, in the wider community that the family law system is fundamentally broken. And I just wondered if you had any views on why that might be or if that's the case.
The perception that the court system was broken was based on the delays. Much of the responsibility for that was in the resourcing of the court. You know, for several years, particularly in the lead up to the merger, when judges retired from the court, they weren't even being replaced in a timely fashion. You know, there were judges who retired and they weren't replaced for a year or two. To say the system was broken was another way of, but without properly acknowledging that the court wasn't properly resourced. You know, the judges of the family court in the 10 years I was on that court were working hard in a difficult, under-resourced, under-supported environment. All of a sudden, the government has poured resources into the court. And just before the merger took effect on the 1st of September, the court announced the commencement of employment at the court of 45 registrars, 45 new registrars all around the country. So it's wonderful to see the government now resourcing the court. It's a shame that it took them getting their model through before they actually committed the resources that were always needed. Naturally and expectedly, they will have a big impact, hopefully, in reducing the number of matters that actually get to judges and take up judges' time.
So, Nino, Colin Forrest has said that he thinks judges in the family court have been unfairly blamed and scapegoated even for what's been considered a broken system in the family courts. What do you think of that?
Look, I think it's a bit of both. I think there's no doubt there's not been enough resources in the family law setting, but it's also clear that judges have a responsibility to do the best with what they've got. And some judges were making decisions that were wrong. Some other judges were letting matters run for longer than they should because they weren't necessarily adhering as strictly as possible to the guidelines of the court, which can allow things to move a bit quicker and allow people to be penalised if they're doing the wrong thing. So I think it's a little bit of both. I think it's impossible to sort of say whether the court would have functioned better with more resources because they never came. And similarly, it's hard to get a gauge on how much judges are to blame because the court was improperly resourced.
Are you hopeful then that this new merger, despite it not being the model that you had preferred, will in effect improve the family law system on the whole?
Oh, of course I'm hopeful of that.
Do you think it will happen though?
Well, they publicly set a target. 95% of the matters that are filed today are expected to be finalised within 12 months. Now, that'd be fine if you were starting from a clean slate with no cases already in the list. So I hope it's possible. And as I say, much will depend on that resourcing and how well those registrars are able to get through a lot of matters without them having to go to judges. But time will tell.
So, Nino, as you said, it's been just a month since the family court was officially merged with the lower level Federal Circuit Court. What have family lawyers been telling you about how this new system is working so far?
Look, they're relatively optimistic. They think that any sort of teething difficulties they're seeing are kind of to be expected given that It's a huge change and it's just happened. So far, so good. It's looking as if there's enough resources there to deal with the new cases. Hopefully, they'll start clearing the backlog of the old. And yeah, what lawyers are saying is, look, if these different methods that they've brought in as part of this single entry framework work, then we will be better off. But it's very early to work out whether that's actually going to occur yet.
What do you think is going to be important to look out for as we start to look at how this court evolves over the rest of the year?
Yeah, there's a huge unknown here, and that's the pandemic. The pandemic hit, you know, before these reforms were initiated. It hit after all the modelling was done that would indicate that this single point of entry model would work. And everything we know is that, you know, the pandemic is going to increase the number of people that are going to need to go to the family court. It has increased the strain on relationships. It has increased, you know, instances of family violence, and it's increased the backlog in the court in some instances because, you know, they haven't physically been able to sit. So even though the family courts have instigated certain things that they say are helping with mitigating some of the effects of the pandemic, it's a huge unknown, as it is in so many aspects of life, what exactly this pandemic will do to the rates of work in the family law courts.
Thanks to reporter Nino Bucci and retired family court judge Colin Forrest. We'll put links to some of Nino's articles on the family law system on the Full Story website. This episode was produced by myself and Laura Murphy-Oates, Rafka Tuma and Camilla Hannon, who also did the sound design. Full Story's executive producers are Miles Martignoni, Gabrielle Jackson and Laura Murphy-Oates. And Laura will be back with you tomorrow. Catch you next time.